Fortune 500 companies trust Interoptic for optical transceivers and cables. Since 2004, Interoptic has provided high-performance optics and cables at a fraction of the cost of OEM gear. Interoptic products are 100% tested and backed up by real engineers. Work with the optics experts at Interoptic. Find out more at interoptic.com/packetpushers.
Today's heavy networking comes to you from the AutoCon 2 tech event being held in Denver, Colorado. Find out all about it at networkautomation.forum. And we're recording in a conference room just before the opening keynote is set to happen. And the format of today's show, roundtable. Four network automators have raised their hand and brought topics that they want to discuss. I'm Ethan Banks, along with Drew Conroy Murray. You can follow us on LinkedIn. Blue Sky, that's right, Blue Sky. Blue Sky Tech is a thing. Drew and I are trying to make it a thing, yeah. And the Packet Pushers community Slack. Find out more at packetpushers.net. Our guests are Ryan Hamels, Senior Software Engineer, Network Tooling at the Zayo Group. Thomas Kernack, Team Lead and Founder at Unimus. Josh Bandera, Services Director at Network Decode, and Dave Kemp, Managing Director at Soul One. Lots of voices and lots to discuss, so let's get right to it. Ryan, let's start with your topic first. And I'm just reading from the notes. You described it generally, crafting tools to listen to the network that can self-remediate or prevent issues from occurring. Flesh that out. What are we talking about here, Ryan?
That is using telemetry. Seeing when events are happening in your network, you know, if you have ports going up and down, light levels changing on fiber, you know, say, because, you know, if you're going to have an SFP module going bad, or someone's messing with fiber that they shouldn't, or it's listening to varying events with protocols, just traffic, it's just seeing and always having a proactive ear so you know when to go in and take care of something before it impacts a customer or other colleagues or other teams within an organization.
So this is about proactivity.
Yes.
And listening, what are the data sources in your mind that you would want to be listening to?
Each vendor has their own. Juniper has a telemetry interface. Cisco has theirs. Every vendor has a special variant because you can do things with GNMI and you can even just use syslog if you have a good system like Graylog, and there's many other Splunk and many others out there. You can craft rules so when data comes in, you can have it fire off to an automation system or raise alerts or things of that nature so that you're trying to be more proactive in, like I say, a port goes down, you can get on top of it. Or if you have a remediation system, it can try bouncing the port, checking light levels. Is this port in maintenance for whatever reason for customer, or is there work, you know, going on? So things of that nature.
Ryan, my question to you would be, how do you see that being different from the traditional SNMP trap, you know, volume? You know, I've got a customer where we get, you know, hundreds of SNMP traps a second, and they're also adding syslog to that. Now they have hundreds of SNMP traps a second and thousands of syslog messages a second. Managing all that data and filtering it out becomes a real nightmare, particularly where you want to store the business logic.
Yes.
So the challenge they've got now is, you know, a legacy system has encoded in it business logic that figures out what's important and what's not, is that fiber optic light level good or is it bad? And some engineer encoded that into the system that parses those logs.
Yes.
And now if we want to move away from that, we have to decode it somehow, uncouple it from some SQL database, some XML template somewhere, and rebuild it.
Right.
Do you think that the modern telemetry is really much better than the SNMP traps? How do you see that developing?
I see it more as data-enriched SNMP. because you can read from the device or it can push, depending on a vendor's implementation. Just like I say, syslog can still be a form of telemetry if you're working on old school, you have your 6500 still out there somewhere or brocades or whatever. Syslog is still better at telemetry than having nothing at all because it may not be just network engineering. If you have a security team or whatever that's, you know, managing your TACAX radius, whatever, and you're seeing a device somehow getting 100 invalid password attempts or what login attempts or things like that, that's still a valid thing to see, even if it's not just for the networking team. You have your security team, you have other teams that are relevant to other pieces of information.
Yeah.
And kind of just go back to another podcast that is coming out on this this week here about observability data as well. It'd be able to start to give context to that, right? Of, hey, you have all this data of 1,000 different interfaces, really start to talk about the source of truth to also then provide context. Is that a core interface or is that just an access interface, right? Which Correct. Have differing values of, okay, just an access interface might wait till 9 a.m. the next day if right. you're on an overnight. But if it's a core interface starting to go bad, you're probably paging somebody out and getting somebody, if you can be more proactive, we all hate that. Hey, as you go down, that you have multiple customers down because of something on the core.
Well, I was leaning into that is, well, an example for being customers is that when you get that port down alert and you have a remediation system taking over, it can, like you say, referencing databases of the sort, it can look up a circuit ID or something that can, it can actually say, is this customer having a maintenance or do we have a ticket open for a dispatch for a tech to go out and actually work on a, you know, clean a fiber or swap an SFP module, things of that nature. So it's expected, so you don't create more noise. So it does heavily rely back on business logic.
Do you have a tool stack in mind for something like this?
A lot of it's Telegraph, Prometheus, Grafana, things like nature. If you're talking like SNMP, that's my world is more Zabbix. I'm trying to think, there was another thing I had in mind, but it's now escaped my head. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It was the syslog stuff. For that, I'm more of a fan of Greylog.
But the automation piece of this then is how you react to the events. The sum event,
yes.
and that's a trigger for some automation event to happen, which is I've been sitting here listening to this, trying to decide, how is this different from what we've done for the last 20 years?
Yeah.
And the answer is, well, moving towards self-remediation, moving towards getting out in front of a problem before it becomes a problem, you know,
right.
like that failing optic, let's say.
Right.
I would say there's like multiple levels to this, right? The easiest level is you have monitoring and you monitor stuff, right? But the next level usually is you want to make the monitoring be autonomous in a way that you don't have to monitor the monitoring system. It lets you know when something is wrong. And the next level to that is you remediate if you can, right? And so all of that, and even with like you have thousands and thousands of data points, you can even do some automated logic. You can do like historic trending, and is it trending the right way? Is there a large delta from yesterday to today? And that might be something that you might want to look at. So yeah, you have a lot of business logic, which is likely hard-coded and dependent on your business, but you also can do a more general prediction stuff and delta over time stuff and stuff like that. And yeah, then the next level is, as we mentioned, yeah, do the automated remediation. And then if that fails, you maybe somebody looks at it, right?
Especially in a world where if an enterprise, the first step when, say, troubleshooting an access point port is to just cycle power on the interface, right? That's a perfect thing to automate. Of, hey, you have the interface go down, it's an access point port. All right, go out to that, do power, you know, just do a PoE off, PoE on, and see if that recovers it. Now, that brings up other things of how, if you're doing that once an hour for that same access point every time. So it does shift what you have to do from a monitoring perspective and the diagnosis. If you have an automated system that's continuously fixing something, but it still might need human attention.
I would say, like, what is the desired state you want your network, your ports to be in, right? And if it is not in desired state, which the monitoring should pick up on, can you remediate that to the desired state? And if not, then probably somebody should look at it, right, and try to do that. And then you do a retrospective and figure out if you can automate that again.
Yeah, so I think that's where it comes back to the source of truth idea. And that's what I've been banging on about for years, which is the desired state needs to be stored in a static, you know, a database with a good API. And, as a practical example, you know, we've taken customers on the journey from discovery where we figure out what the desired state of a network is because they've adopted a network they don't really understand, stored that, and then made sure the monitoring keeps it in that way. You know, these ports are up, these ones are this fast, these ones are this slow, you know, those kind of things. And that way you can kind of have that entire journey of, you know, discovery, source of truth, monitoring, and then close the loop again. And, you know, that's what we've been working on, and it works reasonably well.
I feel like that this is where we run into trouble, because we started with a very simple example of, here's an up-down scenario, can I automate a fix? And then suddenly we're talking about sources of truth and desired state and intent and everything, and it just balloons into an almost unsolvable problem from, I need to do a very simple thing. So how do we get from A to B without having to essentially like rebuild our network?
I think you take it in those levels, right? So first of all, you implement some kind of monitoring. You figure out what is the best way. Maybe SNMP is enough for you, for your requirements. Maybe unit syslog. Maybe you need to actually talk to devices to get the runtime state of the network. That depends on everybody's requirements, right? And so when you have that, you try to make it so that you don't have to monitor the monitoring, right? Try to make it autonomous, that it lets you know. And then you start getting into that stuff. Like, how do you define what you want your network to be like?
But is there any way you can get around monitoring the monitoring? Because if it's an autonomous system and it fails, you need to know that your autonomous system failed.
There's the redundancy, department of redundancy.
Right.
Yeah, so you need to absolutely have something that monitors the monitoring, but that should be a very simple thing. So that should not be a second full monitoring. It should be an external system, ideally, that lets you just know only one job. Let me know if my monitoring is doing what it should be, right?
Yeah, but you wave your hand and say, just get some monitoring. And you're talking about customers that don't necessarily know what they have.
Yeah.
So you actually have to start with, what do you care about?
You can start like both ways. Yeah. So there is a discussion of, where is the right point? It's like a cyclical thing. And that's it.
So I'm going to expand on what you say, what you care about. And I'm actually going to say, loop in other teams within the organization. Because, for example, as I mentioned earlier, the security team, what criteria do they want? What do they want to see? What rules or regulations do they have to comply with? Certifications, all that stuff. So they have to have their set of requirements. And if they're smart enough to, be trained to actually log into the system or piece together rules or something that they want, where they say, like, if a device has five invalid login attempts or whatever like that, I want a security ticket raised, things like that. So it's not always just dealing with packets in one form or another. There's security all the way around. And if you're doing things in the financial world and trading and all that, that is a very big deal when it comes to, seeing just all sorts of different information, because at the end of the day, I see a switch or a router these days, it's a computer with an ASIC that has many NICs, basically. Indeed. And it just so happens to offload that stuff. So sometimes you have to still treat it as a server in some respects, because in fact, with Whitebox, Sonic, and a number of other vendors out there, it's almost like, there's servers at the end of the day, and you can have your systems level monitoring, you have your network monitoring, there's so many things.
They've always been computers. The greatest lie Cisco ever told was it wasn't a computer.
So, and what, overall, just one of the things about network automation in general that, I'm hearing, I think this just conversation backs it up further, is network automation is taking tools that are out there and crafting the business logic from those tools to meet your business needs. Right. And, so you're taking, when we're talking about, light levels, and now we're doing something to what makes sense for us as an organization. Some organizations might not care that the light levels are going down. Right. But as far as Ryan with you, it is a big deal, and be able to be proactive and have that like hospitality type thing, and changing it away from, the carrier went down again, to, the carrier told me it's going down, we're being proactive. That changes the tone and the attitude, which then gets more business going. But the tools aren't built specifically for that. They're going to be generic, and you take and automate or put business logic to that for yourself.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in putting the parameters around what we care about in the source of truth. To be very specific about this, in customers with NetBox installations, we put the fiber optic light levels that are acceptable for this type of device as a field on the device. The monitoring system now knows, for this type of device, these are the things that we think are acceptable. For the site in London, the latency needs to be higher, from Sydney at least. So these are things that I don't think necessarily the idea needs any one particular tool. It's just having the idea of being able to say, I'm going to democratize the business logic to a place where the security team can tag a vendor, a device as vulnerable, you know, and say, for this particular device, if we see excess bandwidth on the interface, then that is really a problem because we know it's really a bad device and probably has been owned by now if that's the case, you know? And so be able to democratize that information and sort of have other people contribute to the source of truth, the things they care about, and then have the monitoring sort of flow through and protect, you know, and reflect that in an operational sense, has been a big vision of ours at least. And, you know, I think people...
And I'll expand upon that one is, I was going to say, going back to like using the fiber light levels and things as an example, is say like if your monitoring system knows how to keep a history over time and it knows like, say you have a port go down, but then it comes back up and your receive light level is 2 dB different. Like, did something get plugged in between that splitting light or, mm-hmm. it, or somehow did that fiber path change and get much longer? I mean, for an example, if you have a diverse wavelength or dark fiber and you have a system that is known to switch between two different paths, that's one thing, and you're expecting that, that's one thing, but it's going back, say, like financial and high frequency trading, if you have such things change, that can create a security, you know, intervention or, you know, to dispatch a technician to actually see what is going on physically, because you cannot always see what you got with your laptop, phone, or whatever your notifications.
It's that design driven, right? Where you're documenting the design and documenting what, you know, the latency is part of the design, right?
It is.
As far as from Sydney to London, it's the design for this to be at X latency, right? And so by having that design in the source of truth, we can talk which source of truth. That's a whole different throwdown, right? But exactly that. I think that's definitely a big theme here of having the source of truth, having that record to be able to show what that design should be.
Let's pause for a message from our sponsor, Interoptic. Interoptic is the optical transceiver and cable specialist that maximizes your IT savings while minimizing network failures. Interoptic provides high-performing optics at a fraction of the price of brand-name optics. The Interoptic experts can help you spec the best optical transceivers and cables for your network environment. Interoptic optical transceivers are 100% guaranteed to be operationally equivalent with Cisco, Juniper, Extreme, Arista Brocade, Palo Alto, and many other switches and routers. Due to Interoptic's deep optical transceiver technical experience, they can ensure that all messages, alerts, alarms, and threshold data are equivalent to OEM brands. Interoptic deploys rigorous 100% testing on their devices before they're shipped. Interoptic optical transceivers are built to the exact same quality standards as the OEMs and typically come from the exact same manufacturing lines. That's why insurance companies, retailers, financial services, and federal and state government customers deploy optics and cables from Interoptic. You can purchase the same, if not better performing, optical transceivers tested and backed up by real engineers at a fraction of OEM costs. Find out more at interoptic.com/packetpushers. That's interoptic.com/packetpushers. And now back to the podcast.
We're talking a lot about monitoring, but how does that really achieve the dream of network automation? And what is the dream of network automation in that context is my next thought.
The question probably even is what network automation means, because that's a...
it is.
We're going existential really fast here.
I'll answer that question real quick, though, around what does it mean, and take it to the vehicles. And we all want self-driving vehicles, right? And really start to... Some places, you know, some vehicles are out there and doing fully autonomous and touting that, but others are taking that step-by-step journey. Going back to the 80s, 90s, you had anti-lock brakes was first automation, right, of slamming on brakes and, hey, they're going to just go ahead and not stay stuck for you and slow you down better. And now nowadays what's really common in cars is that adaptive cruise control, right, of there's sensors that are going to tell you how far away from that next vehicle you are and adjust your cruise control speed. So I think that's where monitoring comes in, of knowing how far obstacles are, but taking that same thing to the network side. Now, network, there's a whole lot of data, a ton of data. You have to choose that right, you know, go down to that vehicle side, choose what you want to automate, you know, get that anti-lock brake first, move on to the adaptive cruise of, you know, be able to start to take one thing at a time.
It's a journey.
It is very much a journey.
So network automation is a journey. We can all agree on that.
Yes, it's been said many times. So I want to move the conversation along to Thomas's discussion, which actually dovetails in really nicely. And Thomas, you brought up the topic of who you're building the tool for. Is it for you as a network engineer? Is it for other people, non-technical people maybe? Expand on that.
Yeah, so and yeah, that ties to, and Vaya even said, like, what does network automation even mean? Because it might be very different for a different person. So for a technical person, you as a network engineer, yeah, you might care about distributing configuration to a large set of devices, validating those configurations, et cetera. But for your business side of things, it might mean something completely different, right? Are you automating processes? Are you writing stuff into databases? And if you are a big network operator, it will be different as if you are a telco versus a mid-level ISP versus an MSP, right? And so I don't think there is a single good answer to what it means. Probably to each organization, each entity, it means something else, right? To what they require and what their network is like, what services they provide, and essentially, yeah, well, what is the...
Does it also mean you end up with multiple tools, maybe? It's something that network engineers care about that isn't really consumable by anybody else.
Yeah, so absolutely. If you are a network engineer, you know, you have your entire... code base that you use to deploy stuff, and whether that be Ansible or something else doesn't matter, right? But it's likely that your business guys will never touch that directly, right? Yeah. Because that's not a tool that's made for them and they can use in any reasonable way, right? So yeah, absolutely. The tooling, and ideally, you would want that tooling to be all integrated and talk to each other and nicely behave with each other. But that's a reality I think we can all agree on is very hard to achieve, right? And so yeah, the technology stack might be completely different, the tooling might be completely different, but also the requirements for what you want out of that system might be completely different.
Yeah, my question there is then, does network automation mean less network engineers?
I don't think so, at least. So what I usually see is that, and maybe you guys will disagree, but as a network engineer, you always have more to do than you have time, right? That's just the reality. And also, the further you go into network automation, at least I feel you move towards software development in the end, right? Because it is what you are doing. You are cross-integrating softwares, you are writing and specifying business logic and what it should do. And that's not what you would consider classical network engineering anymore, right? So there's some cross-skill needed there. You usually come from network engineering background and go into network automation and go into those. But so I don't think it will take jobs away. It might mean you are doing a little bit different things than as a pure network engineer, but I think there's the market still needs more people rather than less for all of this.
So going to that skill set question, do you think it's a different set of skills if you're building for a network engineer a tool to consume internally versus something that is for other people?
So it depends, because like many times the network engineers, again, like if you are let's say mid-size ISP, it's likely as a network engineer you don't have the time to adopt a skill set of, you know, I need to learn Git, I need to learn Ansible, I need to learn Ying, Yang, Python, whatever that is, right? That's a huge, you know, it takes years to master network engineering in itself. There's so many protocols, so many vendors, everything else. And now when you add software engineering into that, and you can, absolutely you can. And it's great if you do it and it enriches you and what you can do and how fast you can talk to your network in the sense. But in most organizations, I think it's actually, yeah, it's a different skill set. You usually take software engineers, software developers, and you explain to them the business logic that you need. And at least that's what I've seen a lot of times. So there is definitely, and it's great if you come up as a network engineer and move into the network automation space. You have much more knowledge and it's faster to pick up. But oftentimes it is actually software engineers and developers that move into the space to help network engineering teams.
So if I'm building for an external user, I'm probably going to have to go talk to other people.
Absolutely. You will probably have to have a product owner who talks to business guys who does your specifications and, you know, all of the business logic. And, you know, you are basically developing software at that point. And that needs the entire software development lifecycle. And yeah, the software is is to talk to the network, but it's still software.
There's the software engineering lifecycle, the software development lifecycle, but then you are really implying there's a human or humans that need to be very focused on that. And if you're a network engineer who's doing software development on the side, you're distracted always, and you're trying to multitask effectively.
So yeah, that's the discussion. Like, what do you need? Because if you are a network engineer who needs to automate a deployment of configuration 500 switches or a provisioning of those, yeah, it's likely you can write that yourself in Ansible in something, right? And it will work, and it will work for you, and it will achieve the job. But that's very different from building, let's say, service provisioning system, mm-hmm. right? That needs to talk to the business people. That needs to maybe talk even to sales, to CMDBs, to inventory systems, etc. Like, that's a completely different level of network automation. And like, yeah, that's why I'm saying, like, your needs will be very different whether you are a network engineer in an, like I said, a mid-size ISP versus a Google or the hyperscalers that build their automation systems in a completely different way. So it's a very broad area of what does network automation even mean, and like, what do you want your system to do, and what skill set, and what there is, like, I think a couple hundred 747s flying, right? But for each 747, there is 1,000 Cessna 172s. And for each one of those, there is 100,000 cars on the planet driving. So do you need a 747 or do you just need a car? And it's a very different skill set to build that and to operate and maintain that.
Yeah, and I think when I look at things coming from an organization that is all network automation, a lot of our engineers and consultants have been network engineers first and gone down that path. That's not the only career path. We've had software developers that are very successful. A few come to mind right away to mind on that. And so it really becomes a team approach aspect of things, and be able to wear multiple hats, I think. You know, so if you're going from the larger places that you can have individuals wear a single hat and have a software developer with the team, great. But if you go to smaller shops where you might have, you know, a handful of engineers, now you're probably doing a little bit of everything together to be successful down that path.
Right? Absolutely. So. And then it's also a discussion of what happens to the company when that engineers don't everything leaves. Like, can you transfer that skill set across the team? Can you train people?
Documentation becomes huge at that point.
Surely,
right?
An outcome of automation is that people can leave. And the system should just keep working the way it is.
Well,
that's a goal.
That's the goal. But the question becomes, like, business requirements change, right? Business logic changes. And can, as a small shop, will you be able to hire somebody who has both the engineering background and the software knowledge to maintain and update that system? And systems get old. There's security that you have to deal with, etc. So, like, yeah, it's a more complicated discussion on.
And I've been somewhere where I wrote an internal tool where I think probably like 6-9 months after I had left, they called me up. Hey, we had this thing happen. Do we need to do anything for your script? And it's like, no, the script's still going. It might still be going out there many, many years later. I'll have to find that out. So,
if I'm building a tool that is for internal network engineering consumption versus a tool that would be external customer facing, like a self-service kind of a tool, does that change who does the development? Like, could I as a network engineer build it if it's for us as a network engineering team?
So you absolutely could. The question is if that's the right way to do it, because that will take a lot of time and that will take a lot of skills you don't have. Like, putting systems and services into production, especially if it's like you say, customer facing, so public service, that's there's a whole set of issues like scaling, availability, security. Mm-hmm. Like, these are systems that talk to your network. So if they're compromised, they have control over your network and therefore indirect control over everything that flows through the network. So yeah, there's a security concern into that as well. So, and again, it depends, like, what are your requirements? Do you want to acquire all of those skills? Are you able to? Do you have the time and budget for that? Because, like I mentioned previously, at some point it becomes a software project that requires serious software development skills.
And yes, and I was gonna say with that, I come from a team where we largely work with backend, always doing REST APIs, things of that nature. And we work with another team that manages a custom customer portal. And so we expose the APIs, we give them the documentation. Here's how you trigger XYZ. So how do you provision this type of circuit? How do you provision that kind of circuit or whatever? So it's it really all depends on we do have front end teams that can do React, Node.js, that kind of thing. And then we have people that can do Python and they can write the core systems that can talk to your CMDBs, your various orchestration systems of that sort. So it all depends on, because going back to saying, yes, you're going to have network engineers that are also going to be programmers, but are you going to be asking too much of them knowing how to do front end, how to do back end, because you're asking them to be a full stack developer on top of being an engineer. And then, oh wait, are you going to be managing Docker containers, this whole pipeline to make that project work? Are they going to be systems engineers to make that system work?
But again, if it's just for us, just for like the engineering nerds who need a script that's going to help them troubleshoot some BGP issue that comes up routinely, and no one else is going to see it but us.
Right.
Can we build that, or do I still got to outsource that to a dev?
Can I answer that? I think just to sum up all of those concerns with one concept, which is input validation. A network engineer is expected to validate the input to those scripts, the parameters to those scripts in their head, and not do something dumb. With great power comes great responsibility. It's in the warning of every sudo and Ansible playbook you should have.
Right.
So, you know, you can very easily do a lot of damage, and you spend all of the time when you have people that are non-technical building a system to validate those inputs. They can be security, parameters, all those other kind of things. And, you know, from a sort of CEO's point of view, the company, when he goes, well, we want network automation because that means my help desk in the Philippines can do VLAN changes on all these switches. You know, and that means that those guys need to have the right amount of input, so they put in the smallest amount of information to make the change happen.
Right.
And the system has to spend all this effort making sure that they're making the right change.
I'm laughing at the input validation thing, because almost every script I've written to do input validation.
Yes. You'll never spend too much time on security and input validation.
And one other thing that I've seen in the enterprise world, because I think we're spanning a few different industries, right? Mm. I definitely got the ISP clear down that path. And the enterprises, you're down the self-service portal. Right, whether that's the CMDB tool that, you know, it's about to start to get a little cold and start to snow here a little bit, aspect of things, is it in that type of thing? And does the input validation happen there versus, and then handing it off to other places? So, but that's, to that point, it's an external customer, but internal to the organization, right? So you might even have a third section of internal, external, and fully external, depending on the business area, so.
But I think to answer your question directly, I think that's usually how it starts. Like, you as a network team have a need to automate something, and somebody from the network team will start writing scripts, playbooks, whatever it is to solve that. So I think, yes, absolutely. You can start internally.
It's the starting point, though.
It's the starting point.
If you end up building a more robust system, things are going to build on those core scripts you start with. At some point, you're not going to be able to sustain the building and maintenance of that system as a network engineering team.
It becomes a full-time job.
Right, because if you can't handle and maintain what you got going on yourself, you're not going to be able to maintain your internal organization web interfaces for your other customers. And then you try to introduce your actual external customers coming in. It's a whole different thing entirely.
Yeah, the other day I learned about Gaul's law, that every successful system comprises of successful, much smaller systems. And so this is exactly it. Build small building blocks, make sure they work, make sure they do the thing that you need to, make sure they work in production, and then build on them as they go. Because every complicated, successful system only ever works if the small parts of it work together. And many people set out to build a really big, complicated system built on some really big, complicated SaaS-based, ticketing system that aims to do everything. And it is cold in here, but the point is that it often never works. It often never works because it is just too hard to make that big, complicated system do those small little add VLAN to interface thing without having the add VLAN to interface thing first.
Well, I think there is, like, you have to recognize, what do you have the capabilities to do, what do you have the needs to do, right? And to a point, you also need to recognize where is the point where you need to hand that off to, like, a serious software development project and team. Because to the point of, I've seen this in actual projects where, you start small, you start with the scripts, but at a point where you need to deploy those scripts to literally hundreds of thousands of devices, you need to be able to write software that scales, that multi-threads, that you know, the performance aspect there. And there was some discussion even in Slack, you can have a job that runs for hours and hours because you need to do some pre-validation, post-validation stuff, etc. And that's a whole completely different skill set. Again, as a network engineer, I don't think it's fair to assume that you will have the skill set to build software that scales to hundreds of thousands of devices and properly performance tune it to be able to do the job. So you need to start small, but that at some point you need to recognize that, okay, you know, do we have the capability to make this into a serious software internal product, you know, or do we need to purchase something else externally, you know? And I don't know what the right answer is, but those are considerations. As you scale the system, as you put it into adoption and use internally or even externally, you need to like actually think about those things. Like running production services at scale, that's, you know, not an easy task.
Yeah. So maybe one last question to wrap up this topic. If I'm a network engineer listening to this and I haven't done any software development and avoided software as much as I could, software development stuff, where do I start small? What are my building blocks that I should maybe be thinking about dipping my toes into, getting into?
For me, and this might be an old-time cliche answer, but TCL is an amazing start point. Tickle the language. And I'm not
Look
saying
at you going back in the past.
Yeah, I'm saying this is very old school.
You wouldn't expect that to come out of your mouth.
Come on, like, if realistically, if there is a network engineer that doesn't know anything about like scripting and everything else, like it's a very contained language. You can open the man page, and all of the functions, all of the calls, there's like 30 of them, you can actually like get that language and syntax into your head quite fast. I'm not saying you should stick with that in any long-term capacity, but like if you want to pick something up that will give you the power to actually do something like in under a week, I think it's a starting point, and you could do much worse.
So I'm going to jump in with a little bit of a contradiction there, and just I'm going to call it friend of network automators everywhere, Kirk Byers. He's got a NetMiko class. NetMiko is basically an SSH library for Python that takes care of a lot of back channel stuff, because I learned some interesting things trying to write something similar to NetMiko at once about how SSH actually works with network devices. So Kirk Byers has a free course, also paid courses. Talked with Kirk a little bit this morning. Definitely want to give a shout out to down that path. I think Ethan, yeah, you've done it in the past, and
I can highly recommend Kirk. He's been, if you look in the Packet Pushers Heavy Networking Library, Kirk's been on the show in past years. And I took the course you're talking about back in the day, back in its early phases. It's advanced since then. But yeah, great material, yeah.
Yeah, I having gone through this process of sitting next to network engineers and saying, right, we're gonna start doing automation now, and the guy's used to sitting there logging into each device, he's got a giant list of, like, where is your source of truth? Oh, it's my secure CRT config file. That's how we know what servers we have and what routers we log into. And this is like my core network. I'm like, well, we can do better than this, right? So let's start there. But to me, Ansible and getting started with some basic Ansible and some YAML is really where they need to get going. These guys, you know, will, you know, I'm like, well, what about Vim? You know, those kind of things. The barrier to entry is really quite, you know, challenging for some of these guys, you know, let alone talk to them about Git and merging things and all the other sort of stuff, you know. And like, they're brilliant network engineers, but, you know, starting to think about, well, this whole time I've been working with a computer, but even though I was trained not to think it was a computer, but it was a computer. And
you
I have a piece
to
of software.
Edit Vim. No one's making you do that.
I am.
I mean, I like it. It's a choice, but no one has to start there.
So, he said TCL. Come on, man.
But the thing, is that I was going to mention basically AI, and because we're now in the, like we say, we live in an information age, and now we can consult colleagues and other teams, and or even, you still have your DevOps team. You even if you have your software engineer team, you know, if you can talk to your manager, to talk to their manager, say, hey, maybe. Can you have an engineer, if they're willing first, you know, like, can they mentor? Like, can they help X, Y, Z? You know, could give, teach a few things, fundamental things. So, I mean, don't have them, so you guys, and then you build a relationship with other teams, you know, you're building up knowledge, you know, it also shows that maybe it opens your other developers' team's eyes to what's going on, where the company needs to automate, grow in other ways. But also, besides that, like I say, ChatGPT, Ansible has their thing now with the Red Hat side. You know, you can type, say, write me a script that changes the login banner for a, you know, Cisco ASR device, and it can do that. You know?
Is that good, though?
Yeah.
So
is it better than TCL?
Well, so I want to expand on that. So I get the hate. I get the hate. But so I feel like we already mentioned here, like, we have Ansible, we have Python, and now we started going down YAML and everything else. Like, I think that's just too much. That's such a barrier of entry for somebody who's never touched scripting or programming or any of those technologies. And even with Python, we can there's Python 2, Python 3, what about environments? What about all the libraries? The first lines are going to be usually import this, this, and this. Like, a person who has never touched any of this will not understand it.
Start working in Python and you begin to feel bad that, like, I don't actually get this virtual environment thing yet and don't want to have to care. And so you just write a script knowing that I'm probably supposed to be doing it a different way and I feel bad, but I'm just going to do this and try to get it.
Right. There's a difference between a quick and dirty script and you're doing a whole CI/CD full-blown application pipeline, managing dependencies,
and
security.
And see how this balloons really quickly. Yes. And I want to avoid that.
I'm going to take it a little further. I do agree with Dave on the Ansible side for workflows. As soon as you start to say you want to do A, B, C, D, E, and keep it going and actually accomplish something that, you know, make a change window or something, that Ansible's absolutely the place I'm recommending, because, again, it kind of hit on it. I have these sets of these commands, and you can see that translated in a flow, right?
Is that a reasonable expectation for a first-time automation job, though?
I can do it in about
show commands.
Half an hour.
You can, but a network engineer who
I can teach someone to do it in about half
an
hour.
And that's another thing which I wanted to talk about.
Without having to learn Python or do anything else. I'm like, install Ansible, run this stuff.
But does every network engineer who wants to get into automation have the ability to have somebody like that teach you to?
A good friend handle of ours of it depends. It truly does depend, right, on those organizations.
And I'll expand on that there with, if your organization, you know, they have their systems engineering and all that, they may be running Ansible Tower or AWX or some of that sort already. So it's there. If you want to expand on, like, the event-driven features or anything of that sort, that's why I've said, like, can you talk to your DevOps, your development team, if they can give you a few pieces here and there, and then run off and see what you can build, and then go back to them and say, does this look sane to you and whatnot? Is this something we can actually put into the system and actually use, and then get company buy-in and start small and work your way up? So make sure you take a look at the tools that are around for the whole organization, not just you, and see if they can be leveraged in other ways.
I think you should be building up towards that. Absolutely, that is the way to do it. But I don't think, again, like somebody with zero skill set right now, that I don't think that's reasonable to expect out of
this community at that point. Go with that is you have people, if there's already Ansible experience in the organization, you can leverage them to teach you the Ansible things while you apply it to the network.
If you are in an environment that's absolutely. If you can get training, if you can get mentoring, if you can onboard yourself into a system where you have that support and help, absolutely the way to do it. Right. But I don't think, at least I think a lot of the network engineers are not in those environments where they already have all of that. And if you are talking about how to achieve buy-in of your organization into networking, right, again, you're going to have to start small. You're going to have to start somewhere, right? And the question is, like, what is that point and what is reasonable to expect that point to be?
Yeah, I think Ansible is a reasonable starting point, personally, from my experience. But it's not the end, you know. It's a step on the journey, and at some point, those Ansible playbooks get a little bit too much, and AWX gets a little bit too slow, and you start realizing that the input validation isn't as what you wanted, and so then people start writing their own software to do all those other kind of things. And I think that's really the journey of network automation we're talking about, is sort of starting with some, you know, text files that are a little bit better structured than a straight cut and paste iOS config and dump it into the terminal, and go from there.
Well, Dave, why don't you develop your idea then that you brought to this roundtable, which is monitoring systems that are driven from a source of truth. And this makes the truth more truthy, you said. So explain all that for us.
Yeah, so we've been working for a while with a number of open source systems, and I'd like to expand the idea without necessarily naming names, because I think that the concept where the configuration of the monitoring system is not in the monitoring system. The monitoring system has hands and feet, it has scale, it has the ability to ask questions of things and receive answers from things, but the parameters that drive it, what you care about, and the settings around those things should be in the source of truth. So we've written software that integrates NetBox and Isinga together, and that is really part of a larger idea where we can take a site, or we can have a guy rack a machine, enter the data into NetBox, and what do you know, he's put the wrong IP address in, or the VLANs haven't been allocated. So because the monitoring automatically picks up that device because he turned it on in NetBox, but the monitoring never comes good, someone goes, well, something went wrong here. So we can go back and we can correct the source of truth, because he was like, no, actually that IP was taken when I went to use it, or that VLAN was the incorrect one, or the cable didn't work that way. So the source of truth gets corrected, the monitoring gets corrected, and everything's green and everyone's happy. So that's what we talk about, by using monitoring to reinforce that source of truth.
Keeping the source of truth accurate, so that the source of truth is not the source of a lie.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which is interesting, because if the source of truth is truly the definitive source of truth in theory, it should never be wrong, and you should always be making the infrastructure conform to the source of truth.
Yes, but reality doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
Reality does not work that way. Data centers are full of mistakes and hysterical raisins, as we like to call them, where, you know, it's a, you know, it didn't work out that way. That stuff didn't actually fit in the rack. I ran out of switch ports, you know, all the other kind of things happen. And we're like, why is this management interface hanging off the core switch, you know, and like all sorts of other stuff that happens, right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's the reality of dealing with of businesses that have budget constraints and time constraints and all those other kind of things. So, you know, yes, it's you know, from a very clean, straightforward provisioning world, the source of truth can be the place where you propagate configuration from, and that's where we want to get to. But on the journey there, having monitoring help you along the way is really what we're trying to achieve.
But monitoring in that case then becomes a form of discovery. We're discovering what the actual state of the network is.
That's
and then
right.
Backfilling our source of truth to reflect reality.
Compliance checks.
We're testing it at a protocol level. We're testing, can I SSH this machine? Can I receive this SNMP OID? Can I hit this API and get back a 200 okay? You know, all those other kind of things are sort of an end-to-end test that we can encode. And if we write our monitoring commands, our plugins in the right way to take the right configuration data, we can build little tools that effectively run those tests and then have them configured directly from the source of truth. So, you know, what one of the things that we've been doing a lot recently is writing monitoring plugins that just take JSON as input. And so that means that we can take JSON from the NetBox API, just pass it in as an argument, and the plugin knows what to do with it. It knows how to authenticate to that API. It knows how to, you know, what latency settings there should be, all those other kind of things. And it makes the whole part very easy to transition. Now, this is not the same thing as observability. It's the same thing as, you know, receiving data from the network and you know, getting a whole lot of signal and a whole lot of noise and then having to sift through it. This is intentionally deciding these are the things we care about, putting the tests in place to make sure those things are happening, and then hopefully having something that's super green. And, you know, I love coming back to a customer and going, my God, how do you have only like less than 1% of things broken right now? Because they followed that step and the engineers followed that step, and it was just like, it's wonderful to see.
Can you expand on source of truth in this definition? Because we've said NetBox, which in the network automation world today, NetBox and source of truth are like, you say them in one breath. An Autobot comes up a lot.
Sure.
Okay, but another way you could do source of truth is not reflecting state of the network, but purely intended state infrastructure as code. It lives in a GitHub repo, and I've got my golden config stanzas of how I wish devices to be configured, which is a pretty different thing, because that's purely, from an engineering perspective, what I expect the network to be, and these are the configuration stanzas to make it so. But that doesn't have a tie to reality necessarily, but can be called a source of truth. Does that fit in?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the term source of truth is relatively, to some extent, loose, because the reality of any given NetBox installation is that it's not the boss of which sites there are. It's not the boss of who the contacts are. It might be the boss of some of those things, but it's not going to be the boss of all of them. And understanding the provenance of that data and then the impact on how that flows through is very important.
Yeah. And that's kind of the mindset around the name of single source of truth, to grab that other information, right?
Yeah.
Very few network engineers listening to actually get to choose where they're going to put their network equipment.
Yes.
As far as what, you know, thinking about retail, the network team has no choice about what.
Yeah.
Where that retail location gets chosen. That's all coming from another system. So exactly right. Go out, get that information from elsewhere. The place that the system of record or source of truth, whatever is authoritative for
yes.
that type of thing. And you need that information, right?
Mm-hmm.
You might be putting that in your SNMP config of, hey,
mm-hmm.
here's the address
mm-hmm.
for this device or whatever it is. Grab that information, have the most up to date, and keep getting it in. So having that synchronization is big.
Yeah,
I think to answer your thing, the infrastructure core versus source of truth, I think there is a distinction between configuration state and runtime state.
Yeah.
Because your infrastructure as call platform usually just keeps the configuration state. You define the state of the configuration you want to be in, and somehow it gets from that infrastructure as code, manifest, playbooks, however we call it, whatever it is, it gets translated into the configuration of the device. But something like NetBox, you can keep much more than just configuration state. We talked about like acceptable light levels, acceptable latencies, etc. And you wouldn't usually have that in infrastructure as code because that's runtime state. I mean, you can, absolutely you can, but
right. And it comes down to how you're accessing it, right? Yeah. Not about NetBox environment, you're getting it from an API.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're in infrastructure as code purely and now that's all on Git, right? That's now you're having to first handle Git, then get the information, whereas an API, go get it. Right.
Well, the thing is, that kind of changes a little bit now that we have InfraHub coming up, you know, where they're trying to be Git-based and they have branching and all these kinds of features. So it's a different UI, but also, and it also with InfraHub, you're not also locked into NetBox models and Nautobot models and that things. I mean, not that I'm saying you can extend it with plugins and all that stuff. So there is that kind of thing. It just all depends on the customizability and things like that. Yeah. But also, that's not to say, though, if you want to go back to your DevOps team, do you really want to say Terraform, things of that nature? Because there is a few vendors that do have plugins for them. So you can say this switch port is this VLAN and all that. So it all depends.
For example, on Juniper, you've had native Puppet support on Juniper for years and years, and you can do all that's of your Juniper directly in Puppet. And
the thing is that while it's been out there, I don't know anyone that uses it.
I think a certain exam finally removed Puppet, even though they originally had Puppet on the first versions of it. So
Chef, anything like that, I've never seen them use it. I mean, I've seen the packages be installed in JunOS, but never used them.
But like, that's a great example of infrastructure as code, where you declare the desired state in a manifest, and the agent assures the desired state is in there, right? And
then you're also getting right back to Ansible as well, right?
Well, kind of, because Ansible doesn't have to be used as, you know, actually declaring desired state. You can just declare a set of commands to be executed, which is different from, like, it's how you use it, right? What is the capabilities?
So
what is the overall value proposition of a source of truth in a network environment when I have my network as it is and it's running, and then I've got this sort of fictionalized, idealized version, and my job is suddenly to try to keep these things aligned as opposed to just, I'm just going to work on the network and not worry about this source of truth thing?
Yeah, I think it comes down to actually the sort of democratization of information. You know, actually breaking down silos between teams is the thing that I've seen. And, you know, you get the cranky old network engineer that, you know, swears at me and says he's not going to put stuff in NetBox, through to, you know, the security guy going, well, what do we actually have on the network? And why did someone tell me that we're about to get owned? You know, why don't you tell me about this thing? So, you know, giving those people a simple place they can go to see exactly what we have, and then, you know, ideally, as we talked about, adjust the parameters around it or whatever it might be. You know, but if you've got a team that does, you know, the project manager buys the gear, they put it in the inventory, they've got the guy that racks the cabling, they've got the guy that, you know, configures the VLANs, they've got the guy that configures the OS, they've got a guy that configures the out-of-band management, all these other kind of things that all happen to get a machine up and running and online. Those teams all need to be working from the same place, the same song sheet, you know, and when you've got a network engineer that his source of truth is his, you know, SSH config file, you know, it's going to be a really, really difficult way to democratize that information that's stuck on his home directory. Huh. You know, so to me, that's the value proposition. And I think that's the major challenge, is because breaking down those silos requires almost a cultural shift in your organization, you know, and that cultural shift is part of the sort of people and processes problem. You know, we all talk about tools and we love to talk about tools, but network automation has to be people, processes, and tools in a, you know, 50-50-50 split.
I think it's... Well, because the thing is, because you need the policies, procedures, and you need people to enforce them. Because an example, say, like, you order something on Amazon and or wherever, and you get that UPS tracker, FedEx tracker, and whatnot, you can go on there and you can see where's that package, where it's got scanned, where it's whatnot. Yes, that's a little bit of automation, but there's still some people involved in sorting, or if you're importing something, there's a few things going on here and there. The idea is when you have the policies that can establish workflows and can hold people to it, and you're using systems like Jira or whatever, you can keep track of that all the way through, and then people up above can actually see what is going on. Are the metrics being met? Are things progress being made? So it's the fact that you keep people out of your hair when you document it then, or you spend an hour or whatever it is, because you're going to have that hour conversation with your team lead or manager, or you can have that sitting in front of your computer typing it all up. So
I think what is important is, and I think we can all agree, it's a mindset shift that you need to achieve.
Yes.
How do I automate stuff instead of doing it manually? Yeah, what tools do I use? What processes exist? How do I share data with others? Yeah, and that requires a mindset shift from just, yeah, I'm somebody who, you know, bashes the keyboard and makes VLANs happen. And so I think that's a different approach to networking even.
Yeah. Well, guys, we're getting to the end of the show, and we have one more thing we want to talk about. Josh, this is a bit of a departure from the rest of our conversation, but this is about containers versus VMs and VMs in containers and so on. Lay it on us.
Yeah, so this, we're recording this right before the conference side, but we've had the workshops so far, which workshops have been wonderful. And as I've attended and bopped around through a few of the workshops, I'd say Container Lab has been a core of many of the workshops and getting things out. So I want to first off give a shout out to Nokia, with Roman really driving a lot with Container Lab. I know there's more behind it, you know, so don't shoot me for missing people. But I think it's been, yeah, it's definitely been an evolution of things to be able to, yeah, to move to Container Lab. And so Nokia and Arista both have native container images available that make it real easy to spin up those labs, and not just spin them up, there you hit go and it's there in a few seconds type thing, right? And so put an ask out to the community as well to put it on the other vendors that don't have container native OSs, and to, hey, let's get that, so that way we can really drive this as far as labbing and being able to do network automation practices, right?
And specifically, not a VM in a container. You said container native.
Exactly. So VMs in a container still take a long time to boot up. So I think there's some stuff. Ivan's done a few things about packaging, the various Cisco images into a container, but those don't boot up and, I just snap the fingers there. It doesn't come up very quickly. And that's where the container side, I don't know if you've got, the rest of the panel has seen container side or want to just, put that out back out there of really make that push, but it's been awesome to see.
Yes, yeah, it has. But you're asking a lot.
I am.
Yeah. It is and it isn't, because there are products out there like Juniper has their containerized RPD. So you have that, and then there's obviously their JunOS vSwitch and was VMX and all that series that they've had. It's being able to break out their components enough to just say, what does it need to just have that CLI and how to type commands, make things work? Because containers are lightweight. Because if you're wrapping a JunOS vSwitch into a container, you're gobbling 4 or 5 CPU cores, 16 gigs of RAM times how many times you're trying to spin that up, versus CRPD, I could spin that up to the cows come home from lab environments for CI/CD and development and things like that for testing stuff, versus using it as a route server or things in between.
It does mean, though, that the vendors have to commit resources to coming up with a container native format for their operating system. And I think that's your point, right?
That is exactly
my point.
It isn't
a straightforward thing from a development perspective.
Yeah, having worked with, for example, there's a Juniper virtual firewall, I've forgotten that. Well, is that a
VSRX?
Yeah, and trying to pull that apart, put it back together, I'm like, what is going on here? The VM is booting another VM inside it, which has something else inside it, and I'm like, this is a mess.
Yes.
And like, absolute mess. And I if that's what we're going to have to deal with in Container Lab, then no thank you.
Exactly, and that's why I want to give that shout out to Nokia and to Arista that have invested that time already, right? That and specifically Nokia that has it freely available. You know, Arista, you do just have to go to their software site and sign up and put your work email in. It's very easy to get an import, but you still have to there's still a couple steps in the middle, right? And so it's a combination of giving a shout out to those that have invested that time, as well as let's ask for more. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I guess the network vendors are wary of containers in the sense that mapping their kernel operations to container network interfaces isn't as simple as it might seem. You know, it's the idea of what is an interface to a machine that is a computer that its job is to handle interfaces, becoming this kind of weird containery thing, I think is, you know, scary to start with and possibly impossible for some of these operating systems. So it's not built with that in mind.
So speaking as someone who likes to do lab work, it's so easy to spin up an Arista CEOS. It just is simple. And so the barrier, but I haven't been especially motivated to go grab some of the Cisco VMs and some of the other stuff that's out there because the Arista one makes it easy. It's very straightforward. And as you're saying, Josh, Nokia, you know, same thing. It's very easy. So if you're a vendor out there listening and you want to make sure that there's people out there using your images, then
make it easy for someone to get it.
Container Lab. Yeah, make it easy for them to get it and fire it up in Container Lab.
There's many of the workshops we're using GitHub code spaces where you're just deploying, having containers. Talking friend of the podcast network, Eric Cho, and myself, as we look at the next edition of the books that we've done, are going down this path of Container Lab is there, and to be able to give, you know, make things to really start to educate and be able to just get moving and with labs. So,
Yeah, and then that is a fundamental software development process, you know, where the classic software developer has something that works on their machine. You know, and you know, it's the classic quote from a software developer, well, it works on my machine. And you can't expect a network to work on their machine without some amount of containerization, because simply emulating any complexity in a VM environment is, you know, very expensive from a computing resource point of view. So, you know, to get network engineers to be software engineers, we need to make it so that it works on their machine.
All right, guys, good place to stop there. I think we're hitting an hour, and I just cut off Thomas, so sorry about that. guys, let's go around the table so people know where to find you on the internet. Dave, starting with you.
Yeah, hey, Dave from Sol1 here in Australia, sol1.com.au. I'm on LinkedIn, Dave Kempe, K-E-M-P-E. Happy to help out with any of your network automation monitoring and open source challenges.
Thomas?
I'm Thomas Kernick, K-A-R-N-A-K. You can just Google for me. I'm pretty easy to find, or unimus.net. And you can definitely find me on there.
Okay, Ryan.
So I'm Ryan Hamel, R-Y-A-N-H-A-M-E-L. You can find me on the internet at ryanhamel.com/social. You'll see all my links there. And Josh.
All right, Josh Mandray with Networked Code. You can find a lot of my socials on josh-v.com. I have a few blog items there as well. And also then the Packet Pusher Slack, the Networked Code Slack, and Network Automation Forum Slack. If it's out there, it's kind of there.
Josh, you did an Ansible course for Packet Pushers that's up on our YouTube channel, too. Yeah,
indeed.
Yeah.
It's a great joy to write.
Yeah, okay. All right, everybody out there listening, thank you very much for listening to Heavy Networking. This is, of course, part of the Packet Pushers podcast network for IT professionals. Find out everything that we have to offer all at packetpushers.net. We have newsletters, blogs, podcasts, and more, and it's all free for you. We are 100% privacy respecting. There's no trackers on our website. There's no login required. If you have feedback for us, you can send a follow-up at packetpushers.net/follow-up. And also remember that this show came to you from AutoCon 2, the Network Automation Conference from the Network Automation Forum. AutoCon 3 will be happening in Europe in spring 2025. Find out more at networkautomation.forum. Packet Pushers is the proud media partner of the Network Automation Forum AutoCon events. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.